From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stephen A. Cohen and his hedge fund, SAC Capital, are huge names on Wall Street. But they're also big names these days over at the FBI, the SEC, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. Prosecutors are going after one Cohen or former Cohen trader after another, charging them with making massive insider trades. The money is so big, breaking the law is so easy, but many see the credibility, the fairness of Wall Street at stake with its fundamental role in the U.S. economy. This hour on Point, the Fed's big insider trading investigation and a hedge fund master of the universe. You can join the conversation. What do you see in this story for the capital markets, for the country? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will speak with the head of the SEC's Enforcement Division about the new push in federal enforcement here. But first today, we turn to Peter Latman. He's a reporter for the New York Times Deal Book. He's been all over the series of investigations around SAC Capital, as in Stephen A. Cohen. He joins us from New York. Peter Latman, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Who's Stephen Cohen, for people who aren't in the biz, including me?
Sure. So Stephen Cohen is, first of all, he's one of the wealthiest men in America. You know, Forbes magazine estimates his fortune at some $9 billion. And he's a hedge fund manager. And over the past decade, floods of assets have flown into hedge funds, which are these investment vehicles. In Stevie Cohen's case, he buys and sells stocks and charges a lot of money for the privilege of doing so. And he's delivered tremendous returns, almost unequaled returns on Wall Street over the past 20 years, about 30% a year on average over the past two decades.
Puts Bernie Madoff to shame on that front.
I don't think he would want to be compared to Bernie Madoff. And you raise Bernie Madoff's name, and it's an important distinction. So Bernie Madoff admitted to being a complete fraudster.
Right.
He was never even executing trades, right?
Yep.
Stephen Cohen has a very legitimate business and has delivered exceptional returns. But now there are questions about whether he or his underlings have crossed the line into illegality.
I just mean that 30% returns year after year after year for nearly decades, that is incredible.
It sure is. And if you talk to people who know Steve Cohen, who have worked for Steve Cohen, they say undoubtedly he is one of the most talented traders they've ever seen. They talk about this sort of Rain Man-like gift for reading the stock ticker. And in interviews with people who have either traded for him or have executed trades on his behalf at the big investment banks, they say he is the best in the business at what he does. And it's a skill, just like being an athlete or being a radio host. He's the best at what he does.
Son of a dressmaker from Long Island, who has made millions. He's become one of the world's biggest, most potent wallet art collectors. Van Gogh, Manet, Picasso, Cezanne, right on. One of those Damien Hirst, that shark in formaldehyde he bought for $8 million. When he doesn't buy, the whole art market shudders. Huge house in Greenwich, Connecticut, where there are so many of those. And a trading floor the size of a football field, I'm reading here, Peter, that he sits in the middle of, and what happens?
Well, he has built up this incredible hedge fund over the past 20 years or so, and he has, you know, hundreds of traders and analysts working for him. He sits at the center of it. It is all quite dramatic. And the way you paint him, Tom, is, you know, this famous art collector and lives in the biggest mansion in Greenwich. But if you've met him, and I've met him a couple of times, he's actually very unassuming. And, you know, one of the great profiles said he sort of has the clerkish air of your cousin the actuary in a zip-up sweater and sneakers.
Right.
I mean, he's kind of an unpretentious guy despite all the things you say about him.
Brian, quite true. I mean, Brian Burrow profiled him for Vanity Fair a couple of years ago and said that over all the CEOs and billionaires he'd met over 25 years, Cohen comes off as the most unpretentious, but it's very, very big money that he's moving. Take us into how's a hedge fund work? How's it work differently from other kinds of traders in stock? And what's the role of somebody like Stephen, or Stevie, as people on the street say, I guess, Cohen, in the middle of it?
Mm-hmm. So a hedge fund differs from, say, a mutual fund. When you invest in a mutual fund, you agree to pay, say, Fidelity or T. Rowe Price a management fee, and it's somewhat modest, maybe 1% or 1.25% of the assets that you give them, they collect as a fee every year. Hedge funds operate a little bit differently. In some sort of cynical people might say a hedge fund is basically a compensation scheme to make a lot of money. And what hedge funds do is say, okay, you're going to pay me a management fee, about 1% of the assets that you give me, mm-hmm. but I'm also going to take a cut of the profits. So if I make, you know, 20% on your investment, I'm going to take a cut of that. And typically, the incentive fee that a guy like Stevie Cohn commands is about 20% in the hedge fund business.
Okay. Wow.
But Steve Cohn's track record is so good that he charges some of the biggest fees on Wall Street and actually now charges about 50% of an incentive fee. So if he makes $10, he takes $5.
So if he's making 30% returns on billions, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, and that's why you see, you know, the art collection and the mansion in Greenwich. And the wealth creation that we've seen in hedge funds over the past decade is really extraordinary. I mean, it's created this new, you know, gilded age almost, both private equity, which we heard about in the mm-hmm. election with Mitt Romney, and hedge funds. It sort of resembles what you saw in the 1980s with, you know, Michael Milken and a lot of those you know, famous investment bankers that represented a different era.
In the junk bond era, though, your colleague Jim Stewart says it kind of dwarfs that. How's it work? How do they come up with returns like this compared to what you're going to get in you know, sort of ordinary investment land? How's it work?
So the secret sauce that SAC will promise its investors, SAC is what you would call an information-driven hedge fund. They're all about research. They're all about getting as much information as they can about publicly traded companies. And then the other buzzword you hear is that they're building a mosaic. And they're building a mosaic of a company so they understand it inside and out, so they're not surprised. And in fact, they can predict whether a company is going to announce a good quarter or perhaps in the instance of a drug company, whether a certain promising drug that is in development will get approved by the FDA. And they do such, you know, deep, deep research that's their edge. And that's why they get such great returns.
But that edge is also where they can go over the line. You got a lot of examples here, half dozen, folks in the SAC circle or formerly there under investigation or facing charges now. Tell us the story of Matthew Martoma and what happened there over the line.
Yep. So that case broke just before Thanksgiving. And as you mentioned, we've seen a few cases involving former SAC traders as part of the much broader, you know, sweeping government investigation into insider trading over the past 3 years. But this case was really quite stunning. The government calls it the most lucrative insider trading case that they've ever uncovered. Matthew Martoma was a Duke University graduate, Stanford Business School. He was an expert in biomedicine and healthcare, and he decided to pursue a career in Wall Street. He was arrested for corrupting a doctor who was giving him inside information about clinical trials of an Alzheimer's drug that was being developed by Elon and Wyeth, two drug companies. And he, in conjunction with Steve Cohen, the government alleges, bought $700 million worth of these company stocks. But then the doctor who was overseeing these clinical trials told him, the results aren't going to be so great after all.
Mm-hmm. At which point, before anybody else knew, before this was properly published or out there, it was just straight
exactly,
to
– Exactly. A week or two before allegedly. It was publicly mm-hmm. announced, mm-hmm. allegedly. And they then went on to sell their entire position in Elon and Wyeth, $700 million, a very
just
large position.
Dumped it and then sort of voted for or bet that it would go further down.
Right. So then they turned around and they bet against the two companies, which is known on Wall Street as shorting the mm-hmm. two companies. And they were positioned for when the companies announced the poor clinical trial results, the stocks tanked. They covered their shorts and made a ton of money.
$250 million sort of netting out here, something like
that. Yeah. So the way the government characterizes it is $276 million in avoided losses because they sold the stock and earn profits because they made a lot of money on their short.
When I think it was the FBI came to Martoma at his house in Florida, they told him all this in his front yard. He fainted in his front yard. What's the connection to Cohen? There are no charges there. He denies having done anything wrong. Is there an alleged connection? What's his status?
Yeah. So this is the first time that any case has tied Steve Cohen to the trades that the government contends are illegal. So Martoma worked for Cohen. And according to the government's complaint, on the Sunday before they started selling off all of the Elon and Wyeth stock, Steve Cohen and Martoma had a 20-minute telephone conversation No, it wasn't a wiretapped call by the government. Okay. They weren't listening in.
Yep.
But they have phone records, so they know that they talked for 20 minutes. No one knows what was said on that call. But whatever was said in that call, the next day, SAC Capital and Mr. Cohen proceeded to sell out of their entire position.
How's Mr. Cohen characterize what happened there?
He was deposed by the SEC earlier this year about the case, and he had little memory of the 20-minute conversation, but he did say that Martoma told him that he had lost conviction in the stocks and that he was no longer comfortable holding such a big position in those names. Which, of course, if that's what he told him and the conversation didn't go any further, that would not constitute insider trading by Mr. Cohen because he wouldn't have possession of the secret information.
Does this look like a noose being pulled tighter and tighter around Cohen? Peter?
Yeah. Well, look, if you report on this and you've talked to enough people, there is definitely an intense interest by the government in Mr. Cohen. And this particular case gets the closest, it would seem, to pressuring this guy Martoma to cooperate with the government and say, I did tell Mr. Cohen about the secret drug trial information.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hedge fund traders, Wall Street players, under a hot investigation for insider trading, including the very biggest person of interest, maybe the biggest target ever, Stephen A. Cohen, master of the universe, in hot water. Peter Lapman is with us from the New York Times, reporter for the Deal Book. There he's covered a lot of the investigations going on, and there has been a great big necklace of investigations here. Raj Rajaratnam of Galleon, off he's gone. Mr. Gupta, former on the Goldman Sachs board, off he's gone. Now, lots of interest, apparently, in SAC Capital and Stephen A. Cohen, who says he's done nothing wrong and there are no charges here. Area of interest. Peter, please stand by there in New York. With us right now as well from Philadelphia is Arthur Laby. He's professor at Rutgers School of Law, specializes in securities law and regulation, spent a decade at the Securities and Exchange Commission, including as assistant general counsel there. Arthur Laby, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
So listeners are responding to this, Arthur. Here's a Michigan says, rein in the greed and return a semblance of health, fairness, and stability to Wall Street. Have things gotten out of hand, Arthur?
Well, I don't know that things have gotten out of hand. Most hedge funds, I think, do operate in a legal, ethical manner. Unfortunately, there are many that don't. SAC, as we've heard, is one of the largest hedge funds around. They employ 900 people. They've got, according to their own disclosures, $43 billion of assets under management. So in that sense, it's one of the largest out there. They occasionally represent as much as 2 or 3% of trading on the New York Stock Exchange. So the government clearly has reasons for wanting to go after the big fish. And of course, that's what the public sees. They don't see most of Wall Street that one hopes operates in a legal, ethical manner.
I mean, people have been pretty upset with Wall Street for a few years now. The country's economy seems to have paid a pretty big price here. How do these – I don't know if it's a bout is the right word of insider trading or I mean, do we go through waves where, you know, ethics get lax and they get tightened up again? Does that happen, Arthur? And if so, where are we in that wave pattern?
Yeah, that's a very interesting area of inquiry. So one story I think here, Tom, is that, look, the government pursues wrongdoing wherever it finds it. It's just a straight up analysis of where do we find wrongdoing, and when the government finds it, it goes after it. There's, I think, another more sophisticated story here that may ring a bit more true with your listeners, which is that the SEC was very much on the run in 2009 when Mary Shapiro came in as the new chairman. She knew that she needed to reinvigorate the agency and needed to show that the SEC was the cop on the beat. We all know that it was difficult to prosecute some of the individuals who were responsible for the financial crisis. That's what the public wanted to see. But insider trading is different. Insider trading cases are relatively clear-cut. They're relatively easy to understand. The public gets it when they see that somebody had inside information, the investors didn't have it, that person traded, they shouldn't have made that money, and the SEC, I think, scores a lot of political points by going after insider trading, particularly in the bigger cases.
So is it political points? I mean, it clearly is that. There's been a lot of demand for something to happen here. But what about the viability of Wall Street, of our capital markets, of, you know, keeping sort of the little guy and his pension engaged here and not fearing, hey, that's a lot of sharks who play by their own rules. I don't want to go in that water.
Yeah, I think that one of the prime reasons that the government is so interested in insider trading cases is to maintain public confidence in Wall Street. There's been a big academic debate for decades over whether the government should be prosecuting insider trading at all. Some people say that companies should just disclose that they allow their executives to engage in insider trading, and investors could simply not invest in those companies. That argument has not won the day. The SEC and the criminal authorities, as you know, prosecute insider trading with a vengeance, and I think they do so in part because they want to show the individual small investor that there's a level playing field and that the markets are fair and reasonable for all investors.
Peter Lettman, presumably they're also trying to send a message to hedge fund traders saying it's not worth it. I mean, the temptation – remind us why the temptation is so large here, Peter, the sums that are involved.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Cohen's wealth, and just take this guy Martoma, who at the time was 34 years old when he made these alleged illegal trades. On the basis of this one big profitable trade in 2008, he was paid a $9.4 million bonus. And he's just one of, you know, hundreds of employees at SAC Capital. And, you know, time and again, I've heard stories about traders at SAC making, you know, into the tens of millions of dollars based on a great year. So the incentives are just huge. And, you know, if your moral compass isn't exactly straight, the temptation, I think, to cross the line is quite great.
There's a moral compass issue, but there's a risk assessment issue, which I guess is their specialty. I mean, it depends, Arthur, in no small part, I suppose it's human nature, on what you think the odds of getting caught are. If you're looking at tens of millions, if you just punch this, you know, hit this button.
That's simply a matter of ethics, Tom. And I think that the larger firms on Wall Street, generally speaking, have a good culture of compliance. That's what the SEC tries to instill. Yes, the temptations are great, but to the extent that the individuals at the top of the firms operate in an ethical manner and they say they simply won't tolerate those sorts of temptations, that should be the model for the rest of the street.
But everybody says that. It's what you do, isn't it? I mean, if we're this close to Stephen Cohen now, he's pretty high up on the ladder of Masters of the Universe there.
You bet. The question about whether Mr. Cohen will be charged, I think, is a difficult legal question. And as Peter referred to earlier, the question there is whether he knew that Mr. Martoma was breaching a duty that he, Martoma, got this information illegally from Dr. Gilman. The problem is that the further we get away from the source of the information, the harder it is to show that the subsequent tippees, mm-hmm. in this case, Mr. Cohen being the tippee further down the line, knew that he was receiving this information in breach of a duty. Oh. And that I think, is the big question in the case.
Not very far down the line, though. I mean, Gilman to Martoma to, if it was there, Cohen, though he says no, but I mean, this stuff is really subtle. How you communicate what you know, kind of wink and nod, or you spell it straight out. In any case, a whole lot of stock traded hands was let go in a big hurry there. Mark in New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, mm-hmm. for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say thank you as well that we finally got a glimmer in this discussion of who the victims are of these crimes. You know, I really wish that people of integrity would retire the term wealth creation once and for all, because this wealth is not being created out of nothing. It's coming from somewhere. It's coming from thousands of victims on the street, and I never hear any discussion about who they are and how, if at all, we're going to make them whole.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. Let us pick it up, Mark, and I thank you for your call. I mean, wealth creation, we know, with great innovations and pushing science and industry forward, that has certainly happened over time. But, Peter, is this wealth creation or something else?
Well, I think what your caller's getting at is that there are victims here, and what the government will tell you is the reason it prosecutes insider trading is to level the playing field. Now, in this particular case, What the SEC might do is they might sue SAC Capital. In fact, they have warned SAC Capital that they might file a civil lawsuit alleging that SAC Capital did not properly control Mr. Martoma and that they should have controlled him better and therefore he would not have broken the law. With that case, they could exact a big penalty. Say there were $270 million in illegal profits. They could double or triple that. And then that penalty would be given back, you know, or put back into a FISC that could help protect individual investors. And the professor might have a better read on that. But indeed, you know, the idea is that the SEC is going to help individual investors and maintain confidence in the markets.
You know, Arthur Levy says it's about ethics here, and there's no doubt of that. On the other hand, isn't it also about some reasonable fear that one might be prosecuted if one deals in insider trading? You have to feel some hot breath of the law out there somewhere, Peter, or it's hard to avoid the huge returns. It's hard to avoid the temptation.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that we haven't mentioned yet, which is a huge point here in this whole investigation, which is for the first time, the government has used wiretaps to record a lot of these traders doing illegal things. And before, they had never used wiretaps. So it was incredibly difficult crimes to prosecute. But now they're listening to these guys on the trading floor doing bad stuff. And, you know, that threat, at least my understanding is that it's really having a deterrent effect and that they are beefing up their compliance and their legal teams at hedge funds. And it is having an effect, the threat that, yes, you might be caught now.
Let's go to Peter in Burlington, Vermont. Peter, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Tom, it seems to me, I'm 65, it seems to me that we have these shows ad infinitum about changing Wall Street. And from my point of view, it just seems like the rich and powerful just, you know, there's a new law, they find a way around it, and, you know, maybe one guy gets caught and the rest get away with it. I just don't see anything changing. I mean, does anything really change, or we just keep talking about it?
Peter, let's take it straight to the top, if we may. I appreciate your call. I want to go right now to Washington and Robert Kuzami. He's director of the Division of Enforcement for the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, former U.S. Federal prosecutor, former general counsel at Deutsche Bank. Robert Kuzami, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We see that you guys have been busy with a lot of investigations, SEC, FBI, Department of Justice. What about our caller's concern right there from Vermont saying, you know, we hear about this and we hear about it and nothing ever changes? Where are we in this sort of ethical history of Wall Street uprightness or otherwise, Robert?
Well, look, in the insider trading space, I think the efforts of the government agencies that you mentioned has sent a pretty strong message that those who engage in insider trading face a substantially increased risk of being caught and prosecuted. Our numbers at the SEC have increased, I think in the last 3 years, nearly 170 insider trading cases involving over 400 persons, as much as $900 million in illegal profits or losses avoided that we have recouped. So we're sending a very strong message. One never knows how much insider trading is being prevented beyond that. I think our view is that we hope to send a strong message of deterrence so that those individuals who might consider crossing the line and engaging in insider trading, when they see that kind of enforcement presence, will step back and choose not to cross that line. That's not to say that there aren't others who won't be deterred or even can't be deterred. But our view is we want to aggressively prosecute this area to prevent as much of it as possible. I will say that, if history is studied, I think you'll see that it does go in waves to some degree. You have a set of prosecutions in a particular area, sends a strong message. The illegality in that area recedes for some period of time. But people have short memories, and over time they may creep back and continue that kind of illegal activity. And it's our hope that through change in the laws and requiring companies to adopt policies and procedures and controls and safeguards, that even if individuals choose to start engaging in that illegal behavior, those changes in laws and rules will make sure that it never gets back quite to the same level that it was before.
Mr. Kuzami, some people say insider trading shouldn't even be illegal. On the other hand, you've got Harvey Pitt, former chairman at the SEC, where you are, saying, he's quoted in the Times saying, far too many people are questioning whether the markets give you a fair shake or whether inside traders are taking advantage of them. Harvey Pitt says that's bad for capitalism, bad for capital formation, and very bad for the country. How do you see insider trading's impact, role, Robert Kazami?
I agree with Mr. Pitt. Look, our capital markets will not survive and thrive and serve the important purpose that they do if individual investors believe that the game is rigged and that insiders have an advantage that they'll never get, an illegal advantage that they'll never get, and therefore choose not to invest in our markets. We need to make sure that people understand and believe that this is a level playing field. That's not to say that some professionals don't have advantages, because if they dedicate their efforts and time to seeking out additional information and doing further analysis, but they won't have some sort of advantages. But individual investors can invest in mutual funds and hedge funds and other vehicles like that and take advantage of that informational advantage and benefit themselves. What we can't tolerate is illegal advantages, and that is obtaining, you know, confidential, material, non-public information and effectively stealing it or obtaining it in a way that violates the law, trading on it so that those persons get an unfair advantage. But I agree with Mr. Pitt. We need to convey the impression that the markets are fair and neutral and a level playing field and encourage people to invest.
If a trader walks into his boss's office with inside information, insider trading kind of information, walks out, and the firm sells a whole bunch of stock, but the boss says he didn't tell me anything wrong, how do you figure out what went on in there?
Well, look, in any kinds of investigations, you look at the circumstantial evidence to determine what occurred. Let's take an example of an individual. If you have an individual who has never invested in the markets and all they have is a 401k plan, and 2 weeks before a corporate announcement, they liquidate that plan and buy high-risk, deep-in-the-money options and make a great deal of money. And you later learn that their next-door neighbor works for the company that who was the subject of the takeover. You may not know exactly what sort of conversations occurred between those two, but you'd have a pretty strong circumstantial evidence that that insider trading may well have.
But what if it's a super trader? What if it's a master of the universe? What if it's Stephen Cohen, who's made, you know, lots of money for a long time by all kinds of edgy investments, no doubt?
Well, that's true. Market professionals, hedge funds and other market professionals who are constantly trading large positions in and out of different securities present a greater challenge for law enforcement in terms of determining whether or not insider trading occurred. But you can see from the track record of the SEC and the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York that we've been pretty successful at it, and we're able to piece together the pieces of evidence and make our cases.
Talk about a mosaic. Robert Kazami, Director of the Division of Enforcement at the SEC, joining us from Washington. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hedge fund traders, Wall Street players, under a hot investigation for insider trading, including the very biggest person of interest, maybe the biggest target ever, Stephen A. Cohen, master of the universe in hedge fund country. In hot water, Peter Lattman of the New York Times Deal Book is with us. Arthur Laby, Rutgers School of Law, joins us from Philadelphia. Peter's in New York. Peter, Arthur, let me go to our callers. Richard in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Richard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to make a slightly different comment from the insider trading,
okay,
which is the main topic,
mm-hmm,
and that is one of the things that occurred in 2008 was that people were doing very highly leveraged investments, and as long as things don't get too surprising and there's not one of those occasional big swings, then they can make a lot of money, and they can make a lot of money for people, and everybody's happy. But when there's a huge swing, then other people end up having to bear the losses, for example, covering the companies that had highly leveraged investments.
Yep.
So I guess that's part of it, is whoever makes the profits should also be in a position to bear the losses. So that's a type of unfairness that I think also needs to be addressed.
There's a bigger dynamic here than insider trading that goes to big swings and highly leveraged bets and all the rest. Peter Lattman, what do you say to that?
Well, it brings up a broader issue of the insider trading prosecutions, right? Since I've been covering these in 2009, a lot of people criticize the government for focusing so much on insider trading. And they say, oh, this is a sideshow. And what you should be really focused on is going after the, you know, risky lending practices and the reckless conduct that was that caused the financial crisis in 2008. And the banking executives' behavior should be prosecuted. And by diverting resources to insider trading, you're taking your eye off the real ball. And I think your caller kind of gets it. You know, there's sort of broader concerns out there, whether it's, you know, the technological developments in the market that regulators haven't been able to keep up with, or the financial crisis cases, that the government has not done a good enough job in either prosecuting or regulating. So I think his call raises the issue of there's a lot of different problems out there. And for a government with dwindling resources, it's sort of a game of triage. What do you focus on?
Mm-hmm. How do you put the fear of law enforcement through the system? But there are a lot of big issues. Quite right, Richard. Lori in Des Moines, Iowa. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was listening to the snippet about the researcher telling Cohen that the report wasn't going to be as favorable.
That the Alzheimer's drugs were not working out so well. Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
Dr.
Yeah.
Gilman.
So why isn't the researcher culpable for what went down? I mean, people who share information that can affect the trading are just as guilty for giving that information prematurely than the person reacting to that information.
Thanks, Lori. Peter, Dr. Gilman, I think I read somewhere he paid $100,000 by SAC. Is he liable criminally or to civil penalty as well for leaking the info?
It's a great question for your caller. What happened here is he made $108,000 for consulting with SAC and presumably has made a lot of other money in a side business of consulting hedge funds on healthcare issues. He was given a non-prosecution agreement by the government, which is highly unusual, which means he will not be indicted for allegedly tipping off Martoma, and he has agreed to testify against Martoma in a trial should it come to that. So the way we read that is that they're applying a lot of pressure on Martoma by saying, okay, the tipper here, the guy who gave him the secret information, we're not even going to charge you. Mm-hmm. But he's going to testify against you and tell us everything that he told you. And that, I think, in the government's view, would possibly pressure Martoma to flip and cooperate against his boss, Steve Cohen.
Arthur Leiby, just to be clear here, under the law, would Dr. Gilman or somebody who's given that kind of insider trading info, are they vulnerable to criminal prosecution or civil penalties?
You bet. They are, Tom. Your caller makes a great point. So the theory here is known as tipper-tippy liability, and a tipper of information can be liable when the tipper receives information confidentially and then breaches the confidentiality, which according to the government, Dr. Gilman clearly did here, and then receives a benefit from sharing that information. And again, as Peter said a moment ago, we know that Dr. Gilman benefited to the tune of quite a bit of money by sharing the information with Mr. Martoma.
Tipper, tippy, but maybe the tippy goes here so that they get more leverage elsewhere. Adam in Boston is calling. Hi, Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to make a comment that the culture change that's been discussed is really concurrent with a change in the structure of ownership of these Wall Street firms. A long time ago, if you worked at a firm like this and you're in a position to do serious damage, you are also a franchise holder. You own
a partner,
a pretty big stake in the ownership of the firm,
yeah.
Partner of some sort, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but today, you know, it's a culture of journeyman, and so people, there's much less. It very much changes the incentives. It very much changes the risk reward calculation. And I think that's a very hard culture to fight merely with prosecution. I think that absolutely helps. Prosecution's a good thing. But, you know, there have been some ideas floated about tying people's long-term compensation and really tying their fortunes to the fortune of their firm. And I think when people, just as home ownership, when people have a proprietary sense, a sense of ownership of the business, I think that it really does tune their behavior. It puts some boundaries around what they do. You'll still have outliers, of course, and bad actors. But I don't think it will be the kind of cultural change that allows people to think, you know, our culture now is just make money quick.
Adam, I take your point entirely. I really get it. On the other hand, if there is now, you know, Steve Cohen himself, Stevie, as they say, an object, a person of interest here, I mean, if this goes all the way to him, what does that say to your theory of the case? He has a huge stake in this. I mean, something like $9 billion of the funds that they invest are his, personally.
The people that work for him are embedded in culture, in the culture. You know, I work in a business where I've been seeing CVs from people from SAC who are looking for jobs. What you see is that the people who work for him, their peers, their business school classmates, all of this infects the industry. It completely changes the values. I'm sure that Cohen, it sounds very much like Cohen's dirty, and he's probably been dirty for a long time.
I don't know. He says not.
But he's living. The point is that people like that, behavior like that is embedded in a culture. And when the culture moves, it's like the tide. You don't have to be swimming, and the tide will move you. And so if you want to fix things, I think one thing you have to look very hard at is changing this journeyman culture of traders, brokers, salesmen. You know, I work for a big corporation. I'm going to feather my nest and then move on. And if there's a mess that's left behind, it's not my mess.
Because they can make a killing in one day, as Peter Lettman says. Arthur Libby, what about compensation structure in this particular world? Do you see it as having migrated in a way that may take away some of the reticence to get down and dirty?
Well, your caller makes a very good point. We all say that we have to follow the money, and compensation schemes on Wall Street are critically important. I think the problem that we've been dealing with for many years is how best to structure compensation schemes so that we appropriately align incentives to improve that culture of compliance. And it's, of course, difficult, as we know, to start placing a lot of restrictions on Wall Street firms, including employment restrictions and requiring having the government require particular compensatory schemes. One additional point here is that the culture, I think, is also changing, not so much because of the compensation schemes, but the government's own interest and their legal authority to inspect and examine hedge funds. That's something they couldn't do before Dodd-Frank, but now the hedge funds have to open their doors to the SEC. They
have to register,
and that I think does as much or more to change the culture than looking at compensation schemes, which has been a perennial problem.
Peter, here's Ed writes to us online and asks a little different angle on this. You know, now I don't know how this lines up with the Martoma story, where we're talking $700 million in shares sold and $250 million swing in the company's favor. That's a big home run, but there are a lot of singles being hit in baseball metaphor land here in the hedge fund business these days, we read. And Ed says, how much of Cohen's success is attributed to high-frequency trading. He says, I know insider trading is an issue, but isn't high-frequency trading also a problem? These folks are arbitraging small changes in the prices in real time and essentially dictating how the market moves, driving out small investors. What about that dynamic, Peter?
Yeah, so that's another area of hedge funds which have gotten a lot of focus, and it's really not at all the core strategy of SAC Capital and Steve Cohen.
Okay.
He has pushed into a lot of different areas over the years, but he's really a stock picker when it comes down to it. He buys stocks and sells stocks. High-frequency trading, a bunch of other hedge funds engage in, and it's, you know, an incredibly sort of esoteric strategy where you're using algorithms and computers to trade stocks and basically make money off of very tiny incremental changes in the stock price. And, you know, if Kusami was still on, he would tell you that that's another area of focus of the regulators, but sort of a different one from insider trading.
Is it illegal?
High-frequency trading in and of itself is not illegal. But again, I think what your writer in there suggests is that there's the potential for abuse. And this is an area that has developed so fast. And the government doesn't really have the capability almost to keep track of the developments. And they're trying. And like Kusami said, they're deploying a lot more resources. But these are, you know, exceptionally advanced technologies that are using computer programs to trade in and out of stocks. They're sort of robots, right?
Yeah. And supercomputers going at it.
Yeah, and they've kind of gotten ahead of the regulatory game. So that's a whole other area, fascinating topic that you could devote another hour to. But it's not really one that applies to the SAC case.
Vic in Glasgow, Kentucky. Vic, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is that I feel like this is more of an attack on rich, on just being rich. It seems to me like the more money that people make, the more likely they're to make a law against the way they make their money. It seems kind of foolish to spend tax money to go after these people that are simply doing what we all dream about, getting that tip and making money. And I'll go off for...
Well, but Vic, what if it's illegal? I mean, what if it's, you know, there's a law and it's illegal and they're going to make a ton and it's going to come at somebody's expense, maybe a bunch of little pension investors. I don't know. What about it?
Well, I just don't think it should be illegal. I mean, when I was a kid, I always dreamed about getting that stock tip and making, you know, millions. And now my investments, I make a lousy 4% off of them, maybe 5%. If I had a chance to make 15 or 20%, I'm going to jump on it. You know, I think it's foolish that it should be illegal. If we allowed this to happen, what would eventually happen is there'd be more and more Steve Cohns, and people would go to them to get their investments. They'd go to them to make that 30% or 15% rather than investing to get 4.
Vic, let her rip, you say, and we hear it. I appreciate your call. Arthur Levy, how about it? As you said, there has been a debate over whether there should even be a law around insider trading. There's Vic, who says this looks like war on the rich. But does it really, Arthur?
Yeah, Tom. Your caller is tapping into a longstanding academic debate in conservative circles. There's a very strong conservative argument that says that the market should make these decisions. We ought to allow companies to allow their executives to do insider trading, and they have to disclose that, of course, to the world. So if one company allows insider trading and the next one doesn't, then you as the investor make the decision and the market will decide. If that company ends up doing quite well, then insider trading is permitted and the market has decided that that's the way to go. I simply don't agree that that's the best solution.
Why not?
I think that Mr. Kazami made the right point earlier, reiterating that when we've got a market where one investor realizes that another investor is trading based on secret information that first investor simply can never have the access to by virtue of his or her position, that person is unlikely to invest in the market. And then we have a situation where we don't have strong liquid markets, which is, of course, what we want in this country.
I mean, Peter, isn't that kind of fundamental here? You can get into a bewildering world there where you've got all different information sets going on. I mean, at some level, that is always very much the case. But if you take it too far, you go at the sort of the capital markets themselves, which in the lore of the American economy have been a big pillar of this historically of this economy's success. There was liquidity that could come in and fund great new ideas because we kind of knew what was going on.
That's correct. First of all, your caller says he makes 4 to 5%. That's pretty good in this market, I want to know.
You must have some tips already, Vic.
Yeah, but that goes to the bigger – look, we've had a flat stock market for more than a decade, right? The markets have been horrible. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal today that investors are really shunning stocks. And then if you add on top of that – you know, sort of a sense of unfairness where if you boil it down, let's get back to that trade in Wyeth and Elon. If SAC Capital is selling that stock with secret information from a doctor overseeing clinical trials, somebody on the other side is buying that stock.
Yeah, who doesn't know that the drug is a dud.
Right. And had he known that, the buyer, she known that, she would not have bought the stock. So there's an unfairness there that these laws are attempting to address.
Here's the other side of that attitude. John writes to us and says, civil penalties are not an effective deterrent. People need to go to jail. What about it, Peter?
Well, I think he'd be happy to learn that since 2009, putting aside SAC Capital for a minute, there have been a total of 69 convictions on insider trading charges in the federal prosecutor's office in Manhattan alone. And I think so far, I want to say about 35 of those have already been sentenced to prison with the rest on the way. So there are criminal implications here, and there have been plenty of people put in jail. Rajaratnam, who prior to Steve Cohn was kind of the biggest figure connected to all of this, is serving an 11-year sentence. So that's some serious time.
Stephen Cohn, you know, many people think he's brilliant. He says he's done nothing wrong. There are no charges. But if this thing continues to go at him and gets him, what do you see the impact of such a big, huge figure in this world? If it should go against him, Peter, what's the impact of that?
Well, look, he's been, for better or for worse, he's been on the front pages of newspapers for the past few weeks implicated in all of this.
Yeah.
I think it's important to say that Martoma, his subordinate, has also denied the charges, and his lawyer said he expects him to be fully exonerated. Look, there's been a lot of publicity surrounding this. We've sat here talking about it for the past hour. I think the message that, you know, the government is going to pursue people breaking the law on Wall Street trading floors has been sent loud and clear. If they ultimately get Cohn, well, you know, he's the really symbolic kind of Moby, you know, he's the
great
whale
white whale
here.
That, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But beyond that, you know, I don't know how much greater the impact will be.
Well, that will be a very big splash if it should come. Peter Lattman reports for The Deal Book at The New York Times, and very well. Peter, thanks for your time and insights today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Arthur Leiby, professor at Rutgers School of Law, specializes in securities law and regulation there. Professor Leiby, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, great to have you with us. Tomorrow, we'll look at unions in the age of right-to-work laws, labor, organized labor, all over the country, after the big fight in Michigan, a very big vote shaping up there today. We'll look at it tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.